His boat had the heels of the James Caird, with the Stancomb Wills in tow. I told him he could try, but he must not lose sight of the James Caird. Just as he left me, a heavy snow squall came down, and in the darkness the boats parted. I saw the Dudley Docker no more. This separation caused me some anxiety during the remaining hours of the night. A cross sea was running, and I could not feel sure that all was well with the missing boat. The waves could not be seen in the darkness, though the direction and force of the wind could be felt, and under such conditions, in an open boat, disaster might overtake the most experienced navigator. I flashed our compass lamp on the sail in the hope that the signal would be visible on board the Dudley Docker, but could see no reply. We strained our eyes to windward in the darkness in the hope of catching a return signal, and repeated our flashes at intervals. My anxiety, as a matter of fact, was groundless. I will quote Worsley's own account of what happened to the Dudley Docker. About midnight we lost sight of the James Caird with the Stancomb Wills in tow, but not long after saw the light of the James Caird's compass lamp, which Sir Ernest was flashing on their sail as a guide to us. We answered by lighting our candle under the tent and letting the light shine through. At the same time we got the direction of the wind and how we were hauling from my little pocket compass, the boat's compass being smashed. With this candle our poor fellows lit their pipes, their only solace, as our raging thirst prevented us from eating anything. By this time we had got into a bad tide rip, which, combined with the heavy, lumpy sea, made it almost impossible to keep the Dudley Docker from swamping. As it was, we shipped several bad seas over the stern, as well as abeam and over the bows, although we were on a wind. Lees, who owned himself to be a rotten oarsman, made good here by strenuous bailing, in which he was well seconded by Cheatham. Greenstreet, a splendid fellow, relieved me at the tiller and helped generally. He and Macklin were my right and left bowers as stroke oars throughout. MacLeod and Cheatham were two good sailors and oars, the former a typical old deep-sea salt and growler, the latter a pirate to his fingertips. In the height of the gale that night, Cheatham was buying matches from me for bottles of champagne, one bottle per match. Too cheap, I should have charged him two bottles. The champagne is to be paid when he opens his pub in Hull, and I am able to call that way. We had now had 108 hours of toil, tumbling, freezing, and soaking, with little or no sleep. I think Sir Ernest, Wilde, Greenstreet, and I could say that we had no sleep at all. Although it was 16 months since we had been in a rough sea, only 4 men were actually seasick, but several others were off colour. The temperature was 20 degrees below freezing point. Fortunately, we were spared the bitterly low temperature of the previous night. Greenstreet's right foot got badly frostbitten, but Lees restored it by holding it in his sweater against his stomach. Other men had minor frostbites, due principally to the fact that their clothes were soaked through with salt water. We were close to the land as the morning approached, but could see nothing of it through the snow and spindrift. My eyes began to fail me. Constant peering to windward, watching for seas to strike us, appeared to have given me a cold in the eyes. I could not see or judge distance properly, and found myself falling asleep momentarily at the tiller. At 3 a.m., Greenstreet relieved me there. I was so cramped from long hours, cold and wet, in the constrained position one was forced to assume on top of the gear and stores at the tiller, that the other men had to pull me amidships and straighten me out like a jackknife, first rubbing my thighs, groin, and stomach. At daylight we found ourselves close alongside the land, but the weather was so thick that we could not see where to make for a landing. Having taken the tiller again after an hour's rest under the shelter, save the mark of the dripping tent, I ran the Dudley Docker off before the gale, following the coast around to the north. This course, for the first hour, was fairly risky, the heavy sea before which we were running threatening to swamp the boat. But by 8 a.m. we had obtained a slight lee from the land. Then I was able to keep her very close in, along a glacier front, with the object of picking up lumps of freshwater ice as we sailed through them. Our thirst was intense. We soon had some ice aboard, and for the next hour and a half we sucked and chewed fragments of ice with greedy relish. All this time we were coasting along beneath towering rocky cliffs and sheer glacier faces, which offered not the slightest possibility of landing anywhere. At 9:30 a.m. we spied a narrow, rocky beach at the base of some very high crags and cliffs, and made for it. To our joy, we sighted the James Caird and the Stancomb Wills sailing into the same haven just ahead of us. We were so delighted that we gave 3 cheers, which were not heard aboard the other boats owing to the roar of the surf. However, we soon joined them and were able to exchange experiences on the beach. Our experiences on the James Caird had been similar, although we had not been able to keep up to windward as well as the Dudley Docker had done. This was fortunate, as events proved, for the James Caird and Stancomb Wills went to leeward of the big bight the Dudley Docker entered and from which she had to turn out with the sea astern. We thus avoided the risk of having the Stancomb Wills swamped in the following sea. The weather was very thick in the morning. Indeed, at 7 a.m. we were right under the cliffs, which plunged sheer into the sea, before we saw them. We followed the coast towards the north, and ever the precipitous cliffs and glacier faces presented themselves to our searching eyes. The sea broke heavily against these walls, and a landing would have been impossible under any conditions. We picked up pieces of ice and sucked them eagerly. At 9 a.m. at the northwest end of the island, we saw a narrow beach at the foot of the cliffs. Outside lay a fringe of rocks heavily beaten by the surf, but with a narrow channel showing as a break in the foaming water. I decided that we must face the hazards of this unattractive landing place. 2 days and nights without drink or hot food had played havoc with most of the men, and we could not assume that any safer haven lay within our reach. The Stancomb Wills was the lighter and handier boat, and I called her alongside with the intention of taking her through the gap first and ascertaining the possibilities of a landing before the James Caird made the venture. I was just climbing into the Stancomb Wills when I saw the Dudley Docker coming up astern under sail. The sight took a great load off my mind. Rowing carefully and avoiding the blind rollers which showed where sunken rocks lay, we brought the Stancomb Wills towards the opening in the reef. Then, with a few strong strokes, we shot through on the top of a swell and ran the boat onto a stony beach. The next swell lifted her a little further. This was the first landing ever made on Elephant Island, and a thought came to me that the honour should belong to the youngest member of the expedition, so I told Blackborough to jump over. He seemed to be in a state almost of coma, and in order to avoid delay, I helped him, perhaps a little roughly, over the side of the boat. He promptly sat down in the surf and did not move. Then I suddenly realized what I had forgotten, that both his feet were frostbitten badly. Some of us jumped over and pulled him into a dry place. It was a rather rough experience for Blackborough, but anyhow, he is now able to say that he was the first man to sit on Elephant Island. Possibly at the time he would have been willing to forego any distinction of the kind. We landed the cook, with his blubber stove, a supply of fuel, and some packets of dried milk, and also several of the men. Then the rest of us pulled out again to pilot the other boats through the channel. The James Caird was too heavy to be beached directly, so after landing most of the men from the Dudley Docker and the Stancomb Wills, I superintended the transshipment of the James Caird's gear outside the reef. Then we all made the passage, and within a few minutes the 3 boats were aground. A curious spectacle met my eyes when I landed the second time. Some of the men were reeling about the beach as if they had found an unlimited supply of alcoholic liquor on the desolate shore. They were laughing uproariously, picking up stones and letting handfuls of pebbles trickle between their fingers like misers gloating over hoarded gold. The smiles and laughter, which caused cracked lips to bleed afresh, and the gleeful exclamations at the sight of 2 live seals on the beach made me think for a moment of that glittering hour of childhood when the door is open at last and the Christmas tree in all its wonder bursts upon the vision. I remember that Wilde, who always rose superior to fortune, bad and good, came ashore as I was looking at the men and stood beside me as easy and unconcerned as if he had stepped out of his car for a stroll in the park. Soon, 6 of us had the stores ashore. Our strength was nearly exhausted, and it was heavy work carrying our goods over the rough pebbles and rocks to the foot of the cliff, but we dare not leave anything within reach of the tide. We had to wade knee-deep in the icy water in order to lift the gear from the boats. When the work was done, we pulled the 3 boats a little higher on the beach and turned gratefully to enjoy the hot drink that the cook had prepared. Those of us who were comparatively fit had to wait until the weaker members of the party had been supplied. But every man had his pannikin of hot milk in the end, and never did anything taste better. Seal steak and blubber followed, for the seals that had been careless enough to await our arrival on the beach had already given up their lives. There was no rest for the cook. The blubber stove flared and sputtered fiercely as he cooked not one meal, but many meals, which merged into a day-long bout of eating.